Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Playing Alone with Others, and it's about a relatively new music label of kind of spooky kid music called Play Alone Records. And our guests for this podcast are some folks who know something about Play Alone Records, the founders, operators, whatever, we could talk titles in a moment. Whoever, Erica Molinier? Yeah. I got it right. And Aaron Gray. See, I got it right and I fumbled. I was like, no. So, Eric and Aaron, hello and welcome and introduce yourselves to the fine folks.
Hello, thank you. I'm Aaron Gray. I would say co-owners.
Yeah.
That would be the title, I guess.
Yeah, co-owners.
Yeah. I'm Erica. This is my fourth time on the podcast because I also do Skullfest, and this is my record label and I DJ and stuff. So.
Yeah. So I guess to get down to it, what made you want to start a record label, or what's the origin story of sort of Play Alone as an institution?
I mean, I would say music is my life, period. It always has been. I mean, I remember being a very small child, I don't know what age, dancing around the kitchen while my mom washed dishes to things like Madonna and Prince, as all of us probably do. and throughout the years, I've been in terrible, terrible punk bands and DJed, and that's how Erica and I kind of got involved. We were DJing together. We do Second Skin here in Pittsburgh. And it kind of went from there, but I'll let Erica talk about it maybe a little bit.
Yeah, it was definitely very much Aaron's idea, because I'm like paralyzed by the number of projects I have going on at any given moment. Mm-hmm. I'm always kind of like running from one thing to another. But if someone gives me an idea that I really like, it's hard for me to say no, because it's like, you know, it's somebody I already work with. Like, we've worked together for probably, I would say, at least 5 years on Second Skin. And so when he approached me to do the label, I was like, sure, why not?
And we're so aligned when it comes to music anyway. Like, we kind of diverge onto slightly different paths here and there. Like, you know, I tend to like, I don't even know what.
He likes more, I think that Aaron likes more electronic music than I like. And I love, like, crushing rock a lot. So, and I go through phases, but, like, I'm in a deep shoegaze phase. Mm. But that's, I might never come out of that one. I'm so deep in there.
Feel ya.
But
yeah, our commonality is post-funk. I mean, The Chameleons, stuff like that. I just saw them in Baltimore. The Sound, I don't know, those sorts of bands from the 80s. And, like, bands from now. Obviously all the bands that we're putting out, but like definitely that post-punk vibe is like kind of like where we found commonality and what we really wanted to do with the label.
Cool. And that's your sort of your sound, that is your sound profile. And
correct.
So there is, I guess, is that, that's a good, interesting question. So like with this, I'm sure you've created this infrastructure, this thing is happening, it exists. There's a website and everything, and there'll be a link to the website on the podcast and embedded into the MP3 and all that. And I guess that's, what does it mean? Or like, so this is sort of like, this is what we do. Can't hug every kitten at the shelter. Right?
Right.
Post-punk. We like other music. And so how does that, I wonder how like that limitation is almost maybe freeing or enabling for the label, because, right, can't you just sign everything that's good?
Yeah, I mean, you could. I definitely think that it is freeing in a way that like, it's also freeing because not only does it have to be post-punk, but it has to be something we both agree on very highly. We both have to agree on it. And we also both value the fact that somebody has to be able to play it live. So if we aren't able to see a band play and they're not as good live as they would be recorded, that's also not something we would necessarily be interested in.
It's a deal breaker.
Yeah, it's a deal breaker.
Oh.
Yeah. So that's why, like, not only, I mean, it's great that we've been able to put out bands from, like, Richmond, Virginia and Chicago, and we can talk about them some more, but, like, those are people we know, and, like, we knew that their band live killed it. Like, they were so good. But that's also why, like, we've been able to put out a lot of local bands, is because we're very familiar with these people. We know that they have the chops to back up what they sound like recorded. Therefore, we're confident in putting out records for them as well.
But I mean, that's not to say, you know, if a band from hit us up from Iceland and they were super sick, we probably would actually get on an airplane.
Yeah, for sure.
And go watch them play a show. Because I think that that's like part of the reason why we do focus like on how bands play live is because I book a lot of shows and I work on Skullfest. And so it's actually important to me that we have a catalog, like, or, you know, as we're building releases, that we've seen all these bands and that we know, you know, right now in music, it's so important that bands tour to be able to sell records. Mm-hmm. So it's like, if a band isn't good live, they're not going to sell records when they tour. And that's just, unfortunately, the reality. So.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to pigeonhole us. We certainly, we're talking to bands all over the country.
Sure.
And we do travel a lot just because we're fans. I mean, that's the other thing about Play Alone, I think, is that, like, we are fans of the music first and foremost, and that's, like, what initiated all of this. So, like, we travel a lot just to see these bands. So, yeah, we're absolutely looking for bands anywhere. We just have to be able to see them first.
Right. Yeah. And I felt like you kind of were saying, like, do you only put out post-punk bands with that?
Yeah.
And I think that that is important to us, to put out bands, like, under the post-punk drama or genre. I was going to say drama, but there is drama. But that's so wide. I mean, that could be, like, from Bauhaus, you know, could be considered a post-punk band, to, like, a band like The Chameleons, which are so different, like, one being more like dark and punk and the other one being more like sad and melancholy and like a little more rock and roll. So I don't really feel like post-punk is limiting because it's such a huge genre. And there's a, you know, one of my favorite bands is the band The Wake. And what's really cool about The Wake is that they were at one point like a post-punk artist that would be similar to Bauhaus. But then their actual favorite music, my favorite music that they put out, is the more, like, what people would say is dream pop, or inspired the genre that is now dream pop.
Oh, wow.
Which is really cool, you know, to see how bands can span, like, from the beginning to the end of post-punk.
And I would say, too, it's, like, really important to us that, like, truly post-punk, in my head anyway, is this idea that it is post-punk. It was all these people that saw those same original Sex Pistols shows, were inspired to play their own music, but not necessarily play punk music, play something more arty or more pop, or just something that was slightly different than punk itself, but still had all the DIY ethics, still had all the politics behind it, still very much supported inclusivity and equality and all of these same ideals. Yeah. So I think that also leads into, like, post-punk as a genre isn't necessarily one sound, but it is kind of this coalescing idealism across all of the different sounds.
Which, yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And thinking about how, you know, I read, there used to be this great feature in the British Music Mag Uncut, and it was called Sacred Cows, and it was written by someone called The Reaper. And it was this just one page, here is something that everybody's supposed to like, but I'm going to tell you why it sucks. And it was sort of fascinating to me. And there were things that I read through there. It was such good, almost kind of borderline critical scholarship, because it's like, I never thought about Alfred Hitchcock the same way again. And it ruined the Shawshank Redemption for me. And there was one about, like, Frank Zappa. And it was brutal about Frank Zappa, but saying about how, like, the idea after punk, someone whose whole musical career was, I can play this because I can,
right,
became suddenly irrelevant.
Right.
You know, and how many ways in which punk was just this scythe that, you know, well, Henry Rollins will say, after you've seen the Ramones, you know, Fleetwood Mac Rumors just kind of goes out the window. You know, it becomes a frisbee, because that kind of excess, you know, and that sort of critical engagement with the world is so important.
Yeah.
You know. So that's part of it. And then to love that music and want to foster it and want to, and Does that change the way in which you engage with the music now that you say being in bands, being a DJ, to suddenly then be, is it a kind of stewardship? Do you feel like it's a stewardship of, you know, we like this, we want, I mean, in terms of motivation, right? Is it a stewardship?
I would say, yeah. I mean, you know, I think I just turned 40 this year. I think we both turned 40 yeah, this year. And we sort of, one of the things that like does unite us is that we are kind of from like the DIY punk scene, but we really are like two people who like what we like. I mean, I definitely like what I like, you know, mm-hmm. which is like, means that sometimes like I'm at a D-Beat show and I'm telling people how much I like Oasis. Like I don't really care, you know, about like people's, like guilty pleasure is not real for me.
They're just pleasures.
They're just things yeah. I like. And so I feel, you know, it's, I think like with that aging and being a person, you know, who has been kind of like in the punk scene for 27 years or so, at this point in my life, I feel really confident that the music I like is decent enough. And that if we both like it, it's probably very decent. You know what I mean? It's probably great.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah.
Because, like, I think that that's, like, the commonality of most of the things that we've put out. Like, you know, that everything's been really, really good or received really well by blogs and labels and stuff. So.
Yeah. And I would say, like, as far as stewardship goes, absolutely. Like, doing this has been such an eye-opener. And I absolutely want to protect the artists that we're working with.
Mm.
Because I want them to create their art. And I want them to be able to create their art in... We were mentioning this a little bit before, like the idea that like music nowadays makes no money, like let alone punk music or post-punk, like there's just no real way to make money. And so I absolutely want to be a resource for these bands that may have otherwise not been able to put out a record. So there's that aspect of it. And that was like a really early on aspect. That was like what got us involved, is like wanting to be able to like help foster these bands to get out there and have their music heard. But, like, as we've delved more and more into it, it's also just weird, like, learning how to do PR, learning how to do marketing, learning how to do all of these things. Like, I think, to a degree, if the bands had to do that stuff themselves, they'd be dirtied in a way. Like, it's weird that, like, even at the level that we're at, it's not dirty because, like, everyone's really, really nice. But, like, you do have to schmooze. You do have to talk to the right people. You do have to get involved with, like...
Network.
Exactly. It's all about networking. It's all about, like... Yeah, kind of, like, buddying up to, like, people. And again, I don't mean that in, like, a gross, like, crappy way, but it's something...
This is not David Geffen in 1976 at Studio 54.
Correct. What you're saying. Correct.
No. Bummer, but...
Yeah. I wish I was involved in Studio 54, but, yeah, I mean, I want to make sure that the bands don't have to deal with that. I want them to concentrate on making the art that they love to make and not be kind of... tainted by the fact that it is this networking schmoozy thing. Like
it's an industry. Yeah.
It's industry. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I will say though, I did have a friend in grad school whose husband worked with Donna Summers.
Oh, there you go.
In Donna Summers' band. And the way she described Studio 54 was Saigon fell, the disco ball dropped from the sky and the gates of hell opened. And that's how she described her Studio 54 experience.
Wow.
As she was one of the people who did not have to wait in the line to get in.
Wow.
The gates of hell had just opened. So if that makes me feel better, you know.
Or I still feel like I missed out somehow.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that's really important to think about. I guess that's that's the thing that I struggle with. I think everybody in the maybe post-punk moment or whatever, or after-punk or whatever you want to call it, moment, you know, I was just reading this really interesting academic article about Crass and our anarchism and how maybe it sort of failed.
Right.
Because then suddenly did it become an institution? And how does something get bigger and yet have this ethos of there's no authority but yourself, but then suddenly, you know, is they were even talking about, like, at what point did they sell enough records that they weren't able to make the sleeves themselves?
Right.
That they had to farm out work to support the band or make the band function.
Right.
And I think we all have that, like, cop in our head, to use the Paulo Freire term, of like, oh, that's a little establishment or whatever.
Right, sure,
you know?
Sure.
And it's, for me, it's an interesting mix of
even for me thinking, like, and I just really have delved into, like, underground local culture, don't really care about. I've been to one arena rock show, one, my whole life. And
good for you.
Yeah, good for me. Yeah, it was boring as fuck because it was Radiohead. So boring. It's like, is it possible? Like, for me, it's like, I struggle with that. I was like, can popular things still be as good? And where do you cross that line over into, and where do you, you know, and I don't want to use the word selling out, but I like this idea of protecting the artists, of saying, you know, we'll take that hit and maybe you can create in a bit of a vacuum.
Right.
Is that?
Yeah, I would absolutely say, at least that's what I'm saying. Yeah. And like, I don't think it's selling out. Like, and I'm not going to say one of those crap lines like, it's not selling out, it's buying in or whatever. Like,
or the Jason Newsted, we sold out every seat.
Oh, yeah. And we're certainly not doing that. But I do think that there's this idea that, like, there's a balance to be struck, right? Mm-hmm. We're still DIY punks, but we work within a framework where no music we want to put out would ever get anywhere if we didn't use some of the infrastructure that already exists, that is the BS infrastructure that, like, we don't necessarily want to be a part of. But yeah, at least if we do it, the bands don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, also, too, I would say that, like, one of the things that has brought us together, which we've talked about a little bit before, is that I'm an accountant, but I'm an accountant for sort of radical folks and miscreants. Mm-hmm. So I do accounting for bands and, you know, like, music festivals and all kinds of stuff. And Aaron does marketing for a living. So we're kind of in a unique position of knowing a lot about, of being, like, people that are into music, but also knowing a lot about, like, business and marketing, that we can use that information that we have, make it, like, open source, like, and also provide that to our bands. And it never, you know, I'm not saying that if we had a record that we had to press 400 times or whatever, and that we wouldn't do that, but we're so far away from that.
Yeah.
That, like, this idea that, like, selling out would happen.
Yeah.
It's like
so foreign.
So foreign that I'm like, what? Selling out? You know, like, I don't even know that I think that I believe in selling out, because I think that, I mean, I guess you could say there's bands that have sold out, maybe, but the most of our friends' bands, like, if they had the opportunity to even make a living on making music, like, they didn't have to, you know, have, like, day jobs, I would be stoked for them.
Yeah. And, I know of, and I won't mention names because, like, I don't know if they would want me to, but, like, I know of a band where they signed to a relatively big label, and they're just stoked that they no longer have to pay to be musicians.
Right.
Like, they still have to have their day job, but being musicians is now free. They don't have to worry about paying for a van or paying for room and board when they're on tour or feeding themselves.
Yeah.
Like, that's the goal. And I don't think that's selling out.
That,
like,
is definitely not selling out. Yeah. I mean, basically, those bands, even in today's, like, indie bands, they're basically just not paying to play.
Yeah.
Because, like, right now, you know, so many bands are actually genuinely paying to play.
Yeah.
Or paying to tour. They go on tour
and lose money.
And they're, like, losing, they're using their own money for tour.
Yeah.
Which is, like, it's crazy that we're at that point in music, you know.
Yeah. And, the expertise that we have, in a way, it's almost subversive, right? Because it's, like, again, none of these bands would have the expertise to know how to, like, do taxes or, like, do these things in a proper way that they won't get screwed on taxes, or, like, do digital marketing, or, like, mess with Spotify in such a way that they get, like, plays and, like, get on playlists and stuff like that. They just don't know how to do that, and why should they have to learn that? They should be the artists that they are, so.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense. And I guess, you know, maybe another way to think about selling out is, I think about after the whole Dave Chappelle show fiasco, when he gave the $50 million back. The next thing that he did publicly was at the Improv in Homestead.
Oh, wow.
And I went to see him, and he said, the only thing he said was about that is, if you see somebody sign a deal for that kind of money, know that they no longer have any control over their own lives.
Sure, yeah.
And, of course, now he does bad comedy like an out-of-touch rich person. So, you know, it kind of got him anyway.
Right.
But, Yeah, I think that is such a careful, especially under sort of capitalism, like, way of negotiating, you know, wanting to be countercultural, wanting to have that punk, what's the philosophy of punk, Tim O'Brien say, punk is an argument with society, right?
Yeah.
But at what point does that argument become part of society? Or,
yeah, you know, sure.
That's a little too Hegel, but... It's a little too Hegel, but you never go full Hegel. Yeah. And so that I think is interesting to me that people, you know, that you're both doing that. And I think it's laudable and admirable. And I get to, I am a play alone completist, as we've established. You're welcome. And it's all good. It's not, you haven't put out a bad anything yet.
Hopefully never. Fingers crossed.
Hopefully never. Well, I guess it's also this question of, you know, having, you know, I think about this a lot, about discursive knowledge. And that because you know things or have heard these things or have encountered these texts, this is the problem that happens, I think, in academia, where we'd, like, there's not this canon anymore. There's not, like, these are the only things that are worth talking about, you know, like in literary studies or art or any of those things. It's like, instead, well, let's talk about how this conversation evolves. And, yeah, is it you two also as people who... have been a deeper, longer part of that conversation, have encountered more information, that kind of, do you just get a better ear or a better sense of of that?
Yeah, I would say that, yeah, that experience does allow that. I would say, again, because Erica and I think both love what we love, very, very specifically love what we love, I think you get an ear for that, and that's potentially a good thing, but I do sometimes find myself kind of narrow when it comes to, like, if something falls even slightly outside of that purview, I'm like, it might be great music, but, like, it's not of interest to me. So, like, I think it's good for the label and good for thinking, for consistency and all those sorts of things, but it might be limiting, potentially, if we're talking about, like, intellectually, like, in a bad way for me as a person, because I'm just focused on, like, this narrow... spectrum of things, I guess. But, I mean, I think it works for the label. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's also a very academic way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that's what grad school is about, knowing more and more about less and less.
Right, right.
So, yeah, it's a very academic, you know, way of thinking about things.
And I'm always researching music, and, like, I can hear... I'll listen to 30 seconds of a song and immediately judge right off the bat, like, whether... that sounds like something I'm interested in or not in. So I can, like, breeze through a bunch of music. But again, is that good or bad? I don't know. But it's very academic.
It's very... I mean, I've had that, like, live experiences. First four notes.
Yeah.
Just knowing. Holy shit. This is the greatest thing in the world. Yeah. And...
right.
You know, that is the greatest... that is the greatest feeling in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Heck yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I feel exactly the same. It's like, I know if I like a song and... a minute. Yeah. I don't change my mind that much about what I like and I don't like. And there's certain, you know, there's certain things that, like, I would listen to, but I wouldn't necessarily put it out. Yeah. Like, I'm sort of in this phase where, like, the, like, Halloween spooky goth music I don't want to put out at all, which thankfully Aaron is in a similar place, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we're not really putting out, you know, stuff that's, like, sounds that way, and we're the things that, like, we do like are probably more, like, more ambient, I guess, more alternative, than
or dreamy,
you know. So,
which is maybe a great transition for, like, can we talk about the lineup?
Sure.
Can we talk about what fine products are available in the Play Alone Media Empire?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. The Empire.
The Empire. So how do we want to do... I actually, because again, being a completist, I have four records and two cassettes up here. I don't know. How do we want to go about... do you want to go in order? Do you want to talk about...
we can go in chronological order.
Or reverse chronological order? The new releases first? Or I don't know. We didn't plan this.
We could just go forward. So the first two things that we put out were a 7-inch and a record, LP... by my one of my best friends, Aaron from Shadow Age. So you might be missing the 7-inch.
No, I have the 7-inch. 7-inch is downstairs.
Okay, see?
But my 7-inches are not in order. That's why I forgot it. But I do have the Silent Age.
Shadow Age.
Shadow Age.
It's confusing.
Shadow Age. I do have the Shadow Age 7-inch. Yeah, yeah. Yes, I do.
So he lives in Richmond, and his band, I think, you know, is one of the best. Like in the, whatever, if we're on the second wave of post-punk.
Yeah.
Some people say we are. He's one of the main artists that came out of the second wave of post-punk. And he recently was playing on tour with Soft Kill. So he's, you know, he's pretty like connected to us, but also other people like that do post-punk music like throughout the country.
Yeah, it was just like a good first starting point for us. I mean, Eric has been a close friend with Aaron for a very long time. All of my encounters, early encounters with Aaron were great. We knew they had good material. Seeing them live was amazing. And, you know, he's had kind of a revolving cast of people playing in the band. And we've known multiple people uh-huh. in that cast as well. And they've mm-hmm. always been good people. So it just made sense for us as a first record. Something that we just knew was good music, good people. This is where we start.
And they sort of, when we put out that record, they'd already put out a 7-inch and they'd been a band for years. So they already had like a following and they'd already toured and stuff, which, you know, made it good for us because it helped us to increase our visibility because Aaron, you know, is kind of everybody's friend in the post-punk community. So,
yeah.
And he's really respected. So. Shout out to Aaron.
But yeah, and the sound is... How would you describe the sound, I guess? That's...
I would say it's not... Okay, so it's dream poppy in that, you know, it's kind of spatial. Mm-hmm. But it is the more gothic rock side of post-punk because of his vocal...
Yes, which is so glorious and deep and right. rich, and
so it does go
soaring synths on top.
Yeah,
of
yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So that's Shadow Age, yeah. And that's been great. And then
after that, after those two Shadow Age releases, we put out the Chicago band Silent Age.
I think Wisteria Tape was next. Actually, I should pull up Discogs because I'll forget. And it's funny that
So the Wisteria Tape says PAR004.
This is a tricky maneuver that happened.
But yeah.
We did the Wisteria Tape technically, I think, was released, right?
I think it was released before that, but it just got done faster.
There's two PAR. They both say PAR004.
Right, yeah, there was a mistake. Which one did come first?
I think the tape came first.
I think the Wisteria Tape came first.
Yeah, and I think it should be three.
It should be three.
And the reason it got screwed up was because... And so this is like, for the fine audience, making records is a weird process because it takes a long time. Yeah. And so making an LP takes much longer than making a cassette tape.
Yes.
Right. That took like 2-3 weeks, mm-hmm. whereas the LP took overall maybe
right.
2 or 3 months.
Yes.
So we didn't know which one was going to come out first. Yeah. Frankly, we were working on them at the same time.
Yeah.
So Wisteria is Aaron's band.
Yeah.
Yes.
You should talk about your band.
Yeah. So that's my band. I've been in lots of I've been in lots of like very DIY punk bands over the years. And then I was in a band called Icon Gallery. And Matt Shore, who is in Wisteria, recorded all the Icon Gallery stuff. So I've known Matt for years. I lived in California for a short amount of time. And when I moved back in 2013, Matt and I started just like jamming and playing, but it was just the two of us. And we kicked around all kinds of ideas where maybe I would sing and like we would get like a revolving cast of people. But it wasn't until, I don't know what year that was, 2017, I guess, maybe, probably.
I would guess.
That we started.
Yeah,
That was out last year. Yeah. So Wisteria started, I think, in 2017. So it was Matt and I. We played with a couple drummers. Nothing really clicked. We finally got this drummer, Steven. He had come to Second Skin for a really long time and just loves post-punk, and he's just an incredible drummer. He's played in like metal bands and things in the past. So we got Steven, and we started playing with him, and then eventually another mutual friend of ours, Elise, we got her to sing for us, and so we just kind of went from there. It's definitely a different kind of band because I am very much into post-punk. Obviously, that's why we do the label. Matt comes from like power pop and surf punk background. Steven, like I said, as much as he loves post-punk, is like a metal drummer. And Elise, I would say, likes like post-punk and gothy stuff, but probably more towards the gothy stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit eclectic. I would almost even lean towards it's like alternative-ish.
We've talked about that before, that Wisteria, you know, has like a... Like, locally, maybe it's a little 10,000 Maniac-y. Yeah. And that it has, like... And while, you know, the... People are always like, what makes something post-punk? And then, like, a guy that I'm friends with here that's a guitar player in Pittsburgh, he said spatial guitar is what he calls
spatial
it.
Spatial guitar, yeah.
So Wisteria has spatial guitar, which is a quintessential to a post-punk vibe. But the vocal is a little bit more... like on the line of alternative music.
And then Silent Age would be next. And so Silent Age is our friends from Chicago. Again, another great band. They sound, at least as far as I'm concerned, like the most like something I think would be on the label. Like they would be the quintessential band that like fits the label exactly.
That's my favorite release that we've done.
This is really good. I was actually just listening to this when you guys came, actually. Yeah.
Very cool.
The people from Silent Age were in previously in a band called Population, which toured a lot, and that's how they I met them, because they were touring with Silent Age was touring, and they had made a bunch of contacts here in Pittsburgh when they toured through Population, so we met them, and it's really spatial.
Yeah,
you know, it's definitely has like a little dream pop influence, which I really like a lot. And yeah, they opened up for the Chameleons last year or 2 years ago, which we saw them with. And that was kind of where we sealed the deal. And we are expect to see a bunch of things from them, we're hoping, in the near future. So
yeah, they're talking about, we can't confirm this yet, but they're talking about doing a winter tour on the West Coast. So that would be really great. And we'll help promote them. Absolutely. On those dates. So,
and I know the guitarist for this band has a Rainbow Machine. So if you want full dream pop, they have an Earthquaker Rainbow Machine as part of the, or at least they did a Skullfest when I saw them.
There you go. Yeah. So, very cool.
Yes. So that's, you don't get dreamier than the Earthquaker Rainbow Machine, I think, which has a magic button.
That's awesome. I'm learning in this interview.
The guitar player at that time that record came out was in is also in the band Wingtips.
Yeah.
So there's a connection with Wingtips.
Yeah.
So you know there's and then the guy that did the art for the Shadow Age LP, that art was the singer for Population, which is very interesting too.
Yeah.
So everything is connected. Magically connected.
All,
And those guys actually too, Benny and Julian from Silent Age have another band, Iron Years, which we're probably going to do a very limited lathe cut release for them as well. So that's actually, So that's like, we're pretty sure that's going to happen, but it's going to be super limited, and that's not going to be for a little while. So, but yeah, very interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I mean, it's like the punk scene. It's all that DIY stuff. Like you just meet everybody over the years, and everybody plays in bands. So.
Well, I think, and there's a wonderful intimacy to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you can meet your heroes, and it won't be that weird.
Yes, for sure.
Then what? Then what happened next? So four. Now we are at the four. So what was five?
I would say that we did
seven.
Silence next, right?
I think so.
Yes, PAR005, Silence. Yes, Countdown's Beyond, which we did have. Well, we can talk about it still. There is an extensive conversation about every song on the Countdown's Begun.
Yes.
Yes.
So we, Silence, the singer is my partner in Skullfest, or one of my partners in Skullfest. I also toured with them a bunch. And that was a dual label release with Profane Existence Records. Which is a classic anarcho-punk record label. So that was cool because we kind of got to have our politics like more out on the...
Yeah, we got to align with something that clearly identifies where our line in the sand
is. That's right, for sure. So it was a split release.
Yeah. Fun stuff. Everyone in this room did backing vocals for this record.
Yes, absolutely. This is true.
Matt, who Matt, who is in my band, recorded it. I did all of the layout for that record. So like that's another thing that we provide if bands don't have access to it. So I didn't do the artwork, but like just putting together the layout, the layer of the insert, all of those things. I know enough about Photoshop to be dangerous, and that's about it. But yeah, that was a fun release because we had our hands in like a lot of it, and they're very close friends of ours as well.
I would predict too that that's probably the most like traditionally punk record we will ever put out.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Because it's a little more. It's like little less spatial guitar and a little more like.
Yeah.
You know, almost like Clashy style.
Yeah.
Guitar something. It's a little different.
Damon, the guitar player of Silence, who's a good friend of mine, has that jacket that is half Crass logo, half Bauhaus logo.
Yeah.
Right.
Split down the back.
Yeah.
And it's like just the perfect. So Play Alone and Profane.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the perfect kind of way of thinking about this record. And you're right. This record is kind of very serious. And that's the thing. I mean, the podcast where I had Damon and Dusty here, it's almost 2 hours long. And then the next week, I was hanging out with Damon, and he was like, oh, by the way, this line in, I think it was, Soundtrack to the Picture, had this other backstory, like these three lines had this like major backstory, this weird moment in Dusty's life that we didn't even get to in the 2 hour conversation.
Wow.
About all of these songs.
Wow. So many smart friends we have.
Yeah.
All right, which I believe then, so if that is five. Wait, what was next then? This is seven?
I would say it might be misordered because I was.
This says six.
But technically that Death Instinct.
Same thing happened.
Yeah. Yes, so we'll talk about Death Instinct then, though the number is weird. So. Yeah. I have a missing number on my label, so it's okay.
There you go.
It's not there.
I would say Death Instinct. I mean, that's probably my second favorite thing we've put out. Mm-hmm. And I hate to be like, here's the ranking, but
I love all of my children.
Right.
It's just
like
one of your kids is getting into Harvard.
Right.
So there, I love the way that looks. Lynn from Death Instinct designed the pink looking tape cover. It's been very successful. Like, folks order it from all over the world, frankly. The reviews on it has been really great. And part of that is because when you listen to it, I think that a lot of people are really into the, like, vocal style, like, post-punk vocal style that sounds similar to, like, Ritual Howls right now, where it's, like, a really deep voice.
Yes.
But then specifically with Death Instinct, the music is, like, kind of this weird mix of, like, The Doors, like it's a little psychedelia, like mixed with post-punk, which is very original and unique and just happens to be being done by kids in Pittsburgh that we knew that were coming to Second Skin. And I make jokes that there are children sometimes, but they're really not that much younger than us. But they, like we just recently went to go see Lust for Youth, and they just happened to be there.
You know, so they're very aligned with like us.
They like almost the same stuff that we like. We all dress alike in a weird way.
Yeah.
Like their band is just really fantastic. And they're great people.
They're total sweethearts. Like I couldn't ask to work with like better people.
Right.
I mean, everyone we work with is great, but the fact that they're here, personally here, and they're just always together. They're like a little
best friends
group. And they're just sweet. Yeah, they're great.
So that one's like definitely it's $5 for that tape. Just throw that money into the wind and get that tape for yourself. Because it is a winner.
Yeah, it is really good.
Yeah. Which, and again, there will be links on the podcast, gonnadiepodcast.com. For both the main page and then, you can just buy all the things.
Yeah. And we will, I'm almost certain, be putting out more records for them in the future. So this is a cassette tape.
Yes.
But very likely.
EP cassette tape, yes.
Right.
We'll very likely be doing their LP unless we somehow.
We die or something.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah, that doesn't happen.
Which then leaves us to
Empty Beings.
Empty Beings.
So this is another awesome record. It's like post-punk, cowpunk,
hardcore.
It's by a very diverse group. I mean, a lot of our bands are very diverse groups, but like most of the people in Empty Beings come from a very hardcore background. So it's interesting that they're playing kind of like in a slightly different genre field-ish. I mean, they clearly all love this stuff too. Shawnee's just a wonderful vocalist, lyricist, front person. She's wild live. Again, live performance is really important. They crush it. Scud is an amazing guitar player. Adam Thomas, who you just had on the show. And Dave Rosenstrauss.
From Rambo's and Concealed Blade and all the other things. But he's the granddaddy of the Bradykit machine, which, you know, is part of helping to put Pittsburgh on the map musically, because our hardcore bands are just destroying every other hardcore band in America right now.
Yes, and it's lovely and beautiful. And I have to say, when I first got this record and I put on Blameless, that opening riff to Blameless gave me chills.
Yeah.
It gave me full chills, like, this is not a drill. You are in a place.
Yes. Did you get the red one? So it's a red opaque record, which is also just a beautiful record.
Yeah.
I get sometimes, like, this isn't a diss to the bands, but, you know, you usually do, like, when we do a pressing, we'll do, like, a percentage color. And so, like, a lot of bands are like, I want a clear record or a white record. And I'm like, bummer. Because I want someone to do, like, a hot pink record.
Yes. So they... Which I have the clear and the white.
Right.
Yes. Not to talk ill. Right,
sure. Yeah. But the red record, I'm like,
yeah. Yes, red record, red sleeve.
Right. It's popping.
It does pop.
Yeah. And I would say, too, like, that one has also gotten great press. Both postpunk.com and Cult Nation wrote about it. And that has been a learning experience literally through the entire catalog. Is like, we knew nothing about PR, who to even talk to about getting bands written about and all those sorts of things. So, like, it's been a little bit trial and error, but I think we're finally at a point now where, like, not only do we know the people to talk to, but we're starting to get, like, people are starting to agree that, like, we're putting out good things.
Yes.
So, like, you know, it's more likely that if we say to some of these people that are, like, bigger in the scene, hey, we're putting this release out, here it is, what do you think? They're more likely to take it a listen, take it seriously, write about it. So we've been very lucky with that. And, yeah, putting things out like that Empty Beings record where it's just, like, nonstop crushing it the whole way through, that helps us as a brand as well. And it sucks to talk about product and branding and all that stuff. Again, going back to like the infrastructure and capitalism, and all that garbage. Yeah. But like the only way we're going to be able to continue to do these sorts of things for bands is if it works.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. Which that's part of like the, conversation. Like Aaron really cares about, like he did a blog post about how bands like can do their own releases and things like that, or how to put out records, just so that, like, you know, kids in their garage in Oklahoma or whatever, maybe they could Google it and read and get info about how to put out their own records.
Yeah, absolutely. I've done two different blog posts. About how to get a record made and pressed from like mastering on the whole way through the process. And then another blog post I did was about like, as a band, what you should know before the first time you go into a recording studio. And I think we would both say this, like if anyone approached us and wanted to know how we did anything, I would happily tell them. Mm-hmm. Like we're not trying to hold some trade secrets or like somehow make ourselves better than someone else. Like we're here to be a resource for all of the bands for the entire scene. It's just that we only financially can support a certain number of them specifically on the label. Because the label is all of our own money. Like we're not getting any infusion from some sort of third party.
Yeah. It's not a silent partner.
No. It's just our hard earned cash going directly into the scene. So.
Right. Which is, it's interesting. 'Cause you're like, Are we like patrons of the arts? That's how it feels sometimes.
That would be, that's part of my lottery fantasy, which I don't play the lottery.
Right.
But I would just, if I was super crazy, stupid rich, I would just put people on the payroll and just be right. like, I mean, now granted, if I was super crazy, stupid rich, I would go like weird Howard Hughes, you know, like where there would just be this chain email and they're like, I want in 3 weeks to go to a show right here, an early 90s style female fronted alternative band. And I want to be able to buy the CD right. at the merch table, but it has to be that like Ryko disc tinted green that they had back then. Okay. You have 3 weeks.
Right. Make it happen. Yeah,
make
yeah.
it happen. That's what I would do, but, and it would be insufferable, but also people would be able to
right.
make like, their art.
Both of us. Yeah. Neither of us is by any means rich, but for some reason we just are, have become patrons of musicians. Maybe because we love music so much and, you know, maybe because we live in Pittsburgh, we don't really have any expenses,
yeah.
you know, we don't really spend,
well,
we don't spend money, really.
You know, I was talking about this before when you guys first got here and not on the podcast, but I had this really bizarro experience at a pop culture conference this weekend where I presented a paper about, you know, a classic rock artist, and I was, this does not happen much anymore, but I was the youngest person in the room.
Interesting.
And people were presenting on music, and the folks, it was this very romantic idea about, you know, some songs are just better than others, and that's what makes things popular. That's what the final comment of the Q&A was. The guy who was presenting on Bob Dylan said that, you know, other people were like, you know, Buffalo Springfield is the best band, but, you know, they got screwed by their man. It was like this really weird, and I said, you know, what about the fact that the industry has collapsed? What about, like, the post-Napster world? And, like, people weren't even ready to think about that?
Right.
You know? Or the economics of music. It's like people record albums now so that they can go on tour, as opposed to the other way around.
Right,
touring
right.
was a way of selling records. And, like, that these alternative economies are springing up. And for me, it's thinking about this podcast and talking to both of you right now is thinking about how, if you really care, there has to be a way, whether it is the GoFundMe or the Patreon
right.
or whatever, is that just where we all are moving towards some model where we help each other out?
I would say yes,
yeah.
for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. And I even think, so again, my background is like digital marketing. And a few people have tried this and failed, but I even think the future of advertising digitally is actually some sort of share. So instead yeah. of us absently giving our data to everyone, right, and then they're able to market us based on Facebook data or cookie data or whatever, that's all going to collapse. Like,
yeah.
cookies are going to collapse. Facebook's already been in trouble a bunch of times. At some point, you're going to have a say in saying, I'm willing to share my data, but whoever is advertising has to give me a cut of what they're paying for it. So, Amazon's doing something, they're testing something like this, where it's like, if I watch a video on a product, right, I'll get a discount on either that product or even my entire order. The weird thing about that, though, is, like, you're paying to watch advertising. It's just a very interesting...
It's a very interesting thing.
Yeah. And I don't know that it's going to work, but I'm just, yeah. I do agree that we're moving into a different stage where, like, yeah, you can't support yourself on just creating a good product. And
yes.
creating a good product is subjective anyway. Like, to your point
yeah.
about, like, these older people saying, like, a good song is a good song and that's just the way that it is. That's absurd. Like,
yeah.
art proves that wrong. The definition
yeah.
of art proves that wrong.
Yeah.
Like, I worked at the Warhol Museum for a really long time, and say what you will about Warhol, but in the time he was working, a lot of people, they originally, pop artists were known as the new vulgarians, because
yes.
what they were creating compared to a classical art, people were saying is just garbage. It's like, whatever.
It's not possible.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you think even like you look at the history of punk, right? The time when punk was seen as the end of Western civilization.
Right. Right.
You know, pop art was the end of Western civilization.
Yeah.
Rap was the end of Western civilization.
Right.
And it's actually, no, this is a new regenerative force.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah, and I think for us, again, post Napster, if you want to be a fan of music, you have to, I think people have to figure out a way, like, just listening to something on Spotify is not enough.
Right. And I think education is, like, really important in general, too. Like, I mean, we don't get enough opportunity to teach anyone anything these days. I mean, we do, but in some ways it's really hard to get a new concept across, right? So, like, younger people don't realize that, like, when they listen to their favorite artist, even if it's, especially if it's a DIY artist on Spotify, that artist does not get anything. Like, it's fractions of a cent for every play. And they don't realize that. I'm sure if they had a better understanding of that and, like, were willing and able to support that artist in a different way, they would. But we live in a society, too, where a physical record, that's not even necessarily wanted anymore. Like, it's it's kind of a niche thing to want a physical product. I mean, I'm a record collector. I love records. Yeah, I think they're beautiful. But I feel like for younger generations, that's not necessarily a priority to have a physical copy of some sort of music.
They want, like, a Crosby and maybe, like, 2 or 3 10-cent records from Goodwill. But not necessarily the records of their peers making independent music that's, you know, really moving.
Or even understanding why it costs so much for something like that.
That's true.
I mean, the fewer records we make, which is really interesting, the fewer records we make for an artist, the less margin we receive. So it's harder and harder for us to even recoup our expenses. But we have to press fewer and fewer records because there's no market for pressing thousands of them.
Right.
So,
like we were talking about this before we started, but a lot of our friends that, you know, have bands that people deem to be successful, like, you'd be shocked about how limited the runs they're doing for records right now. And some of the big labels, like, won't do more than, you know, 250 records per release, which that's like nothing.
Yeah.
250 records is like nothing. And, you know, it ends up being about double the price to put it out. So that's why records, like, if you buy a new record right now, it's like about $20. And it's because everybody's only doing about, like, pressings of about 250. And they're like, everything's extremely limited.
Yeah.
And that's because things are not moving the way that they should be, you know, because people are not buying records the way that they should be.
Yeah.
And then, it makes each individual record really expensive.
And then labels are getting creative. I mean, even some of the bigger ones, like Sacred Bones or whatever in our little sphere, will do things where they have the actual record, but then they wrap it in paper that's been printed on, and then they'll wax stamp it. So, like, yeah, it's this idea that everything is super limited to kind of market it in a different way so that, like, you're feeling like you're getting, you know, a piece of history. I mean, every record is a piece of history, but, like, you're getting this pressing that, only 250 people could have gotten, but you got the first 50 of them. They're hand numbered. They have this, like, wax stamp on them, like, whatever. So it's interesting trying to get creative enough to, like, make something so limited that it's, like, truly a collector's item rather than just a piece of music.
Well, you know, there is a Kickstarter, I believe, for the first, you know, home lathe.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, it's super crazy expensive, and I think blanks cost $30. But the first CD burner that you could buy at home was $25,000.
Wow. Oh my goodness.
And it was in 1990-something. It was $25,000, and blanks were $20 a piece. So maybe that's the thing. Maybe we'll just all be making records in 10 years.
Well, and that's so fascinating to me, too. And who knows? Maybe we'll be 3D printing them or something.
Yeah, 3D printing them or...
Yeah. But it's, like, so fascinating to me, too, that, like, CDs came all this way for us to kind of go back to records anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, CDs were a form of planned obsolescence. The Library of Congress wouldn't even stock CDs, but they would stock records because CDs would fail after a while because of being planned obsolescence. So, yeah, I mean, I think records in general are a better physical format. And a friend of mine actually is in, I think, Tucson right now. She's taking a course on lathe cutting records. So that's something I'm fascinated by. Like, might be something in the future that, like, I would willing to, on my own, purchase a lathe. And then, I mean, again, it would be super crazy limited runs, 30 records or something like that. But just for the ability to do it. Because, again, I'm a fan. We're fans. if I had the ability to do that, why wouldn't I do that? So, but certainly I'm obsessed with records.
Yes. Records are good. Cassettes are good. I still like the CD.
Yeah. I mean, that's fair.
I still buy CDs.
I mean, I'm glad you buy music on all formats.
I don't believe in obsolete formats.
Yes. There you go.
I can take you a tour through downstairs at the Entertainment Center because I have formats people ain't even heard of.
Nice.
I got stuff. All right. So I think on that note, I think that's... Well, and now time for the bottom five.
Okay.
Bottom five. Bottom five series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. And again, so that the folks listening can get perhaps a sense of the group psychology of Play Alone. I'm going to ask these five questions, but you have to agree on an answer. And you have to talk through it.
Right.
On the hot mic.
Yeah.
All right. So the first question is a time travel question. What historical event do you wish you could have experienced?
I mean, I'm going to take a stab in the dark just because I know we both love these things. Like the first Cure show or something like that.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I was thinking of something like the first time New Order played... You know what I mean? But Cure show is a really good example.
Yeah.
Like, imagine being in the audience, you know, and that super hot, like, 70s Robert Smith comes out.
Yeah?
Because, I mean, I'm not to say... I think he's one of the best people on the planet.
Yeah.
In my opinion. I was reading about... I'm really into, like, the Enneagram or like the Myers-Briggs, and him and I have the same, me and Robert Smith have the same Myers-Briggs, which I feel good about. But he, you know, nowadays he doesn't look like he did in the 70s. But that
happens to all of us.
Right. Yeah. But the short haired, you know.
Yeah, very cute. Yeah. Very attractive.
Yeah. I think I was fetus when that happened. So, which makes me feel good, actually. The Cure has existed my entire life.
Yeah, absolutely.
My entire
and they should exist
postnatal
forever.
Life.
But the positive of that would mean that we would probably be, like, you know, 13 or 14 in, like, 78 or something, 79. So then we'd actually just get to live through the 80s.
And I think that that's always been my dream, is exactly that.
Totally.
To live through the 80s?
At that age.
At that age.
Because we both lived the whole way through the 80s.
Yeah,
but we were too little.
To understand it, yeah.
To, like, actually, like, party
in
the 80s. We didn't party. We just...
I understand, yeah, no. I'm 2 years older than you guys. Yeah. I just want to have 7-Up Gold again.
I forget that.
Remember 7-Up Gold?
I remember that.
A completely pointless soft drink, but it was 7-Up Gold.
Wow.
Yeah. But all right, first gear show. All right, question two. What's the most pleasant sound in the world?
I don't like music that doesn't have melody.
Yeah, same.
So, like, super melodic music is what, that's probably, like, our commonality.
Yeah.
Is that we love super melodic music. Like, I'll go to a noise show or whatever because I want to support, like, our friends who are noise artists and stuff. But that whole, like, the acid jazz, free jazz, noise rock sets or whatever are, when I'm in there, I'm like, you know, it's a little brutal.
And so maybe melodic... dripping with reverb, guitar, something or other.
Is the most beautiful. Mm.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Probably played by Mark Burgess from the Chameleons.
Yeah.
You know, some like maybe on, I'm trying to think of, or The Sound.
Yeah.
Adrian from The Sound.
Yeah.
Who we both love The Sound and the Chameleons.
Yeah.
So.
So yeah, very, very on brand, I'd say.
Yeah.
Yes, very on brand. So far, yes. So let's see how this keeps going. All right, so question three is more of a prompt. Tell me about a turning point in history most folks either don't remember or perhaps don't understand its importance. A moment the world changed that most people maybe don't recognize or most people don't think about.
Go ahead.
You go. I answered the last one.
I mean, I was just going to say it's going to, like, the typical answer would be, like, the whole punk movement. But I don't want to say that. What were you going to say?
I sort of am having a lot of, like, ideas lately about that, you know, 45 kind of got a hold of us because there was something that happened, like, in the Obama era where, like, all these, like, moderate folks, like, thought that things went too far to the left, but nobody realized that that was going down until election
day. Yeah.
That, like, nobody was talking about, like, how, you know, maybe things had changed, like, in the Obama era so much, like, to the benefit. And I'm not, like, a Obama. I'm not like, oh, man, I love Obama or whatever. I'm like, not into partisan politics or whatever, but it's like we almost, you know, we got, like, too liberal or something, and then, but we didn't even realize it was happening. In the meantime, people in Oklahoma were probably, like,
pissed.
Right? They were like, what do you mean, you know, gender's non-binary? You know what I mean? And they, like, freaked out and, like, went wild at the voting booth or something.
Yeah, and I would say, yeah, I definitely align with that. And, right. like, just, like, another swing to that is just the fact that, like, I didn't realize I was living in a bubble. Like, I had no idea. I mean, I realized the Midwest was the Midwest. And
yeah, Midwest and the South is the South. And yeah, but I guess for me, it's the thinking about, like, for us, like, I've issues with the idea of we live in a bubble because we're the ones who learn to live with other fucking people. And, like, the segregated rural... Actually, this was part of that paper I presented at the Pop Culture Conference in front of a room full of boomers who, like, couldn't grasp this idea that even that, like, whiteness is this, like, thing that shapes reality and shields us from reality or whatever, that, you know, those sort of the segregated rural, you know, or the segregated suburbs... But somehow, those of us who, like, are at peace with other kinds of humans...
Sure.
...are somehow... Yeah, it's weird. It is weird that there are this split of the two Americas.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and you're right in a way, too, because, like, yeah, I grew up, like, a complete redneck. Like, I grew up in the reddest of red Pennsylvania, like, as far as, like, Pennsylvania and whatever. And so, yeah, I did have to learn how to... be who I am and be very much, like, open and left and humanist and however you want to, like, define that, but still be able to communicate with those people and not, and understand that they are people. I think that that's the other thing that's, like, baffling in, in the era that we live in is that, like, somehow we're so dichotomized that we stop realizing the person we're arguing with is actually a person.
Yeah.
And, like...
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be honest that I'm, like, what do you mean people are into that? You know what I mean? They like him? They're, like, into Trump? That's happening? Like, who are those people?
Yeah, I'm related to some of those people.
Yeah, same.
All right, question four. It's an either or, so at least we do get albinary. Which would you rather share the world with on a regular basis? What kind of beings? Robots or ghosts?
So I know my answer, but I don't know that it's going to be one that we agree on.
Definitely robots.
Okay, cool. We're aligned.
Yeah, so.
For different... You should say why you would do it with robots, and then I'll tell you my reason.
So...
But mine's very obvious.
Yeah, me. So I'm all about... I don't believe... why can't I think? Terminator, what's the...
Skynet.
I don't believe Skynet would happen. I'm of the camp that, like, generally speaking, more intelligence... more wisdom usually means more empathy. I want the overlords, the robot overlords, to take over. Like, I don't think people can govern themselves. I think we would be much better off if some self-rewriting intelligence could... We could create that, and within seconds it would be way smarter and have way more wisdom than even what we programmed into it. And it would just make sure that we all were kind of nicer to each other. That's why I would like robots.
So I knew that his reason is way different than mine, but this is still the same answer. Like, you love sci-fi, he loves technology, so, like, those kind of things, you know, of course he wants robots. For me, I am so I'm not going to drop the F-bomb. Or can we?
Yeah, it's marked explosive.
I'm so fucking scared of ghosts. Like, the idea that they're, like, if the spirit world was, like, opened up, mm-hmm. because I'm, like, culturally, like, Catholic or whatever, they're, one of our friends has on Facebook, like, their religion is Catholic romantic. Mm-hmm. I'm not Catholic or whatever, actually practicing,
yeah.
but I'm, like, raised Catholic.
Catholic, getcha, yeah.
So I have, like, the fear of... Like, I'm superstitious and all that stuff. Like, mm-hmm. a little, not witchy, but just, you know, I think you can divide oil and Italian stuff.
No, I feel little... you, yeah.
So that if I was, like, it we were just sitting here and there was some ghosts and shit, that's, like, my worst nightmare. Yes. To be, like, seeing them and communicating with, like, the other plane. I don't want to communicate with the other plane. I'm scared shitless. You.
What I think is a very raised Catholic thing. Right. I had a friend who had the experience of watching The Exorcist with Muslims. And they were just like, what the fuck is this?
Like, this makes no sense.
This makes no fucking sense. Like, this right. is a really boring movie. Like, really? This is the most boring movie we've ever seen. And, like, yeah, but if you're raised Catholic, it's the you get it's the tubular the, belt, like the tubular bells. Nightmare. It's like, you know, I remember one time I was in bed and this is when I was at St. Francis, raised Catholic, right. and somebody was watching The Exorcist in the next dorm room, and that music, like, I was drifting asleep, and I was like, fuck, I'm awake, I'm alive now, oh god, oh god, oh god, shit, so I get it.
My best friends in college had gone to Gettysburg, and they made this tape of them talking to each other by the campfire. And they would play it in the house, like, and after, because I was an accounting major, they were all liberal arts majors. Mm-hmm. So I would go to bed at, like, midnight. They'd be up till 4 in the morning every morning. But they would listen to this tape, and they said there were ghost voices on it from Gettysburg.
Fuck off.
And no bullshit. They're in the living room with the ghost tape. I'm in my bedroom. I can hear the voices that they identify are the ghost voices. And it's, like, fucking torture. Like, worst... thing ever. The fear. I have the fear.
I get it.
I have the deep fear.
We lived in a house then in college right. where Danelle and I met, and there was daytime house and nighttime house. And nighttime house was a different thing with different people in it that weren't us.
Right.
Right.
And yeah. Question five imagines what if there is, you know, we have 45. Then we have the Play Alone administration. Maybe that we become a dictatorship, but you, Play Alone Records, oh becomes gosh. The dictatorship of this land. What would your first edict be? What would be the first Play Alone executive order to reshape our society?
Wow.
Under the Play Alone dictatorship?
I just saw this post on Facebook, and this is the only reason why I'm coming up with this answer. But it was talking about classic video games, and I think Zelda was the example. But it was this idea that you had a coin purse, right? Mm-hmm. And you had so much money you could fit into that coin purse. And the minute you had that much money, the rest of it just spilled out into the land and anybody else could take it.
Right.
So my edict would be something like that, like a wage cap or like something like that.
Maximum wage.
So similar idea, but because I'm an accountant, I'm always thinking about tax structure. So, you know, like the average American pays 45% taxes, whereas that's like the wage tax or whatever. The average billionaire, based on like corporate and capital, because most rich people are rich, not because of labor, but because of capital. Capital is generally taxed at about 20%.
Mm.
So my change would be that capital, which is at, like stock market shit, was taxed at 45%, just like my labor was. Or, flipsy, labor is taxed at 20%.
Yeah. I'd get behind that.
Capital's taxed at 45%. Because that would basically just, like, blow the whole MFR up. It would just be like...
So I'd say that distribution of wealth would be...
Totally. Distribution of wealth is our answer.
Yeah.
We want wealth to be more evenly distributed. Yeah.
So what's next for Play Alone? What's on the horizon? Is there anything you can talk about before we end here?
For sure. And I'm glad you bring that up because I felt badly. Yeah, that we forgot.
We forgot, but I remembered.
Good job.
There's a note.
So Kaivos, who I would say actually falls a little bit outside of the post-punk genre in general for us, or what we would classically think of what we were going to put on the label. But they, as an artist, I think, from the standpoint of creating really great music, having a really great live performance, and also aligning very politically with the way that we think about things, they are just incredible. So we approached them to put out a second record for them. They already had a first record out. So we will be releasing their second record. So again, that's Kaivos, local artist. They play a lot, so I highly recommend everyone check them out. We will be putting out their second record, but also because their first record did not have a physical release, we're going to help with that too. So first we're going to do a cassette and a CD so that they have something physical to sell at all their shows before we do their second full length.
Oh, wow.
So that's what I think. We have other things in the pipeline, but that's the most for sure thing happening. And that will be two releases, basically. Re-releasing physically their first record and then putting out their second record.
And they're a really interesting artist. They ended up in Pittsburgh because they were passing through and their car broke down here.
Yep.
That I understand.
They're from Austin originally.
Oh, wow.
And they were doing music there. And then they kind of ended up here, like, on a whim. And for Pittsburgh, you know, Pittsburgh's, like, most livable city. All these people that from all over the world think that Pittsburgh is like super metropolitan, but for people that actually live here, we're like uh-huh, Stoller's,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
it's very metropolitan
from Manny Brothers,
right? Yeah. But Kai is definitely doing something that is really unique for Pittsburgh.
Yes.
In that their music is kind of, it fits us because it's like kind of dream pop, and it there's similarities, you know, that we see between that and like Molly Nielsen or Grimes, like other, like more electronic artists that we really like a lot. And we're also really, we're really excited about working with them because we believe in them.
Yeah. Definitely an artist that we would love to see like take off. Like,
right.
They have the chops and they have the heart and the spirit for it. We really wish them the best.
Yeah. So, and then also, in the more rock and roll vibes or whatever, my friends that live in Philadelphia have a band called Deep Tissue, which if you went to see Pink Turns Blue in Pittsburgh, you've seen them, or if you live in Philadelphia, you've seen them. And they are a female-fronted post-punk artist. Again, they're incorporating a little bit of like alternative sound into their music, but it sounds more like alternative, meaning not so much alternative, like 10,000 Maniacs, but more like Sonic Youth.
Yeah.
It's more like post-punk that kind of sounds like Sonic Youth.
Ooh.
Guitar-wise, but vocally, like, it's pretty, the vocals, like, kind of Susie and the Banshees, like, traditional goth. So it's really cool.
Yeah. Very powerful live.
And they're in the mixing room right now. So we're hoping that that will be out in the spring. So, yeah, and you already talked about the Iron Years thing. So that's, like, three potential things that we have going on.
Yeah.
So.
Always moving.
Always moving. So, all right, I think that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it's going to be about something. our homepage where you can find new and old episodes is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podcast Addict, and I forget to put up on Mixcloud, but, you know, it's there, some of them. Follow us on Twitter at Gonna Die Podcast, and We're All Gonna Die is also on Facebook. Thank you to Andrew Fox for the amazing theme music, and thanks again to our guests, Erica and Aaron.
Thank you.
Later, meets. 2, 3, 4!